We find ourselves post-Pesach, and we're in what I can only really refer to as a Torah jet lag, in the sense that Parshas Acharemos happened last week in Eretz Yisrael. It has yet to happen this week. We'll follow the Parshas, of course, of Eretz Yisrael, which leads us to Parshas Kedoshim for this week. And Kedoshim begins, of course, with the mitzvah of Kedoshim Tihyu. And let's just have the words in front of us in Perek Yotes, Pasuk Beis. Daber el kol hadas b'nei Yisrael v'amartar lehem, speak to the entire assembly of the Jewish people and say to them, Kedoshim Tihyu. You shall be holy, Kedoshim Tihyu. It's a very interesting mitzvah. It sounds quite obvious in terms of pinning down what it actually means. That may be another question. Rashi famously comments, because again, the verse introduces the mitzvah by telling Moshe, Daber el kol adas b'nei Yisrael. Speak to the entire assembly of the Jewish people. And Rashi says, Melamed, this teaches us, Shene'emar parsha zo b'hakel. This section was said to all, in the assembly of all. Mipnei sherov gufei Torah teluyim ba. Because many major principles of Torah are dependent on this idea. So Rashi picks up on the fact once again that the Torah emphasizes that Kedoshim Tiyu should be said El Kol Adas B'nei Yisrael, to the entire assembly. And Rashi says, because it is said in the presence of all. What are the full implications of this idea that Kedoshim Tiyu is said in the presence of all, in public as can be? Many Mefarshim explain, Rabbi Yaakov Naiman, for example, that really this touches the question as to what Kedusha is. Kedusha, holiness, can potentially be a very abstract idea, a very lofty idea, so much so that it might not be accessible. What is Kedusha and who is it for? And the Torah's answer to this is not what we'd expect. As if to say, when we think of holiness and we think of sanctity, we might think, and there are many who do think, that the concept of Kedusha is in the province of select individuals, of special people, elevated people. And not only are they few in number, but they are largely detached from the general populace in order to pursue their practices of Kedusha. And to this end, the Torah says, no. Kedoshim Tihyu was said in the assembly of all to teach us, number one, that it is accessible and available to all. And number two, the place where it's accessible is where everyone is. One doesn't need to run far away or find some type of isolation in order to pursue Kedusha. On the contrary, the Torah proceeds to give concrete examples of where Kedusha lies. It lies in respect for people, respect for parents, keeping Shabbos, respecting people's money, being honest, and all of these practices which are really societal practices and the way a person acts and towards others and with others. That's where Kedusha lies. One could almost paraphrase the pasuk later on, Lo b'shamayim hi. It's not in the heavens. One doesn't need to ascend to some remote place in order to find Kedusha. It's right there with the people that surround us, in all the activities that surround us, if they're done right, if they're done in a Torah way. And indeed, it's easy to gloss over this because we say it so often. But before we perform mitzvahs, the text of the bracha is, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. Hashem sanctified us with his mitzvahs. The Kedusha that Hashem bestowed upon us doesn't come from things beyond the mitzvahs. Of course, it can include that, but it starts with the mitzvahs themselves. And if perhaps if we take even just a moment once in a while to mull over those words, Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvosav, just to realize how much power and how much Kedusha energy is in the mitzvahs that we do. And this, therefore, is the opening message, as explained, explicated, based on Rashi, that Kedoshim Tihiyu, it's all around us, and therefore it is fully accessible to us, and therefore expected from us. Otherwise, it could be relegated to some abstract idea, which may never be fulfilled at all. So with our newfound definition of Kedusha, let us proceed to take a look at one or two mitzvahs, well-known mitzvahs, in fact, of the Parsha. And as we'll see, there's quite a lot to say about them. And the first place I'd like to go from here is to Pasuk Yud Ches of Perek Yud Tes. 19:18. Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Yud Tes. And what does it say? Lo sikom velo sitor es b'nei amecha. Two negative prohibitions. Lo tikom, nekoma. Do not take vengeance. Velo titor. And do not harbor a grudge. The word noter is an expression of keeping something inside, noter, to harbor a grudge. The second half of the pasuk, of course, needs no introduction, va'ahavta l'arecha kamocha, and the Hashem, to love your neighbor as yourself, but I'd like to focus for the main part this evening on the first part of the pasuk, lo tikom v'lo titor, not to take vengeance against someone else and not to hold a grudge against them. Again, lofty sounding ideas. What does this mean? Rashi actually illustrates both. And let us see his words. What is the classic archetypical nekama or nekima to take revenge? Lo tikom, says Rashi. Amarlo. If A says to B on day one, Hashileni malgalcha, please lend me your sickle. Amarlo, and the second person says, Lav, no. Okay, so day one ended with a no. The first one wants to borrow the sickle from the second. No. But then Lamachar, the next day, the second one comes to the first one, who was jilted by him. Amarlo hashileni kardomcha, will you lend me your kardomcha? Kardom is a spade. Although internationally, I think it's known as a shovel. It's getting harder to call a spade nowadays. But hashileni kardomcha, lend me your shovel. Amarlo eini mashilcha. And the first one says, no, I'm not lending it to you. Kederach shelo ishaltani. You didn't lend me the sickle yesterday, so I'm not lending you the spade today. And that is that. Says Rashi, zohi nekima. That is taking revenge. And that is the negative prohibition here. Not so easy to overcome. Perhaps a natural feeling. That person didn't help me. I should naturally feel that I don't want to help them. Says the Torah, do not do that. Even if they said no, you should still say yes. And certainly do not say no just because they said no. And what about the second matter? Lo titor. Ve'ezoi netira. What is the issue of bearing a grudge? Amarlo hashileni kardumcha. If on day one he said, lend me your shovel, and amarlo lav, and he said no. And then lamachar. The next day, amarlo hashileni malgalcha. Will you lend me your sickle? Amarlo halach. Take it with pleasure. Ve'eini kamoscha. I'm not like you. Shelo ishaltani. You said no to me. Yeah, I remember that. I'm not going to say no to you. I'm saying yes, but don't forget, you said no to me. Zohi netira. That's no titor. That's bearing a grudge. Shenoter ha'eva belibo. He keeps it in his heart, festers there, harbors it there. Afapisha eno no came. He's not responding with a no. He's responding with a yes, but it's not a nice yes. He hasn't forgotten. It's part of the yes is your no. So these are Rashi's two illustrations of lo tikom v'lo titor. Interestingly, and we're not going to go into it, but I think it's worthwhile mentioning it just to remind us of the attention to detail that we find in Meforshei Rashi. If we look closely, we'll notice that the items that were being negotiated here or asked for have been reversed in the two examples. In the case of Lo Tikom, the first item asked for was the sickle, and day one was the shovel. In Lo Titor, the second, bearing a grudge, the first item was the shovel, and the second was the sickle. And actually, the Mefarshim, each one in their own way, explain why the choice of item was reversed in the two illustrations. As I say, we're not going into those explanations. Is there a difference between lending someone a shovel, lending someone a sickle, and so on and so forth? But I mention it only just to see how important it is to notice these things. But be that as it may, I will mention before we get into Lo Tikom, the prohibitions themselves, a fascinating question is raised by one of the Rishonim, the Chizkuni. And that is, the first one who refuses, the one who says no on the Sunday in these two scenarios, no one ever says anything bad about him. In other words, he only really sets the scene for the one who says no back on Monday, or who says yes, but I didn't forget, on Monday. But the Chizkuni asks, why is it that there are no words that the Torah addresses to the person on Sunday? After all, no one did anything wrong to him, and someone asked him for something, and he says no without any reason. What's worse, asked the Chizkuni, to refuse to lend someone something for no reason? Just because no? Or to refuse because they didn't lend you, which is still wrong, but it's understandable. It seems like the first person is worse. He doesn't even have a reason to say no. And yet it seems the Torah lets him off. There is no verse in the or phrase in the verse but that relates to him. But the truth is, says the Chizkuni, that in a sense it really is the second person who's worse. Why? Because on Sunday, when A says to B, lend me your sickle, and B says no, as much as we'd like him to say yes, because isn't it nice to lend your things? But if he says no presumably because he likes his things. Perhaps he's stingy by nature. And although one shouldn't be stingy by nature, that's a question of his own midos and his materialism and his relationship with it, but it's not about an interpersonal relationship with the other person. There is no element of sina, of ill feeling between the two. I just don't want to lend it to you because I don't. The second person already has turned it into an interpersonal thing, because as Rashi explicates it and gives us the speech bubble, he says, I'm not lending you because you didn't lend me. In other words, all things being equal, I'd be amenable to lending it to you. And I'll lend it to someone else. And if you hadn't said no to me yesterday, I would for sure say yes to you today. So that's not an issue of stinginess. It's an issue of a soured relationship. It's an issue of a toxic relationship. And that already is a matter of sinah. And that the Torah addresses. You cannot relate to another person like that. As if to say, if we could summarize what the Chizkuni is saying in one sentence, because it is a fascinating question that he raises. They really should both say yes. But when A says no on the first day, it's because of his relationship with his possessions. When B says no on the next day, it's because of his relationship with A. That's already, that's not acceptable. But as we come now to the heart of the matter. After all, what's it all about? The Torah says, don't take revenge. And let's ask a Bala Batish a question. Why not? As if to say, what exactly is the Torah demanding of me? Is the Torah saying, listen, it's perfectly understandable that you'd like to take revenge, you're just not allowed to. As if to say, the Torah leaves you with your feelings, but doesn't allow you to express them. It's natural for you to wish to say no, just like he said no to you. But the Torah said, don't say no. Just don't say no, regardless of what you're feeling inside. But actually, as we look in these sources, we will see that at the root of this prohibition is actually a perspective that one needs to develop, and that's why you shouldn't say no. That's why, even if he didn't lend you, you should still lend him. You should be looking at things in a certain way where you shouldn't feel that you want to say no. You should feel that you want to say yes. What is that perspective? How could a person naturally develop a vision whereby he said no to me, but I still feel that I'd like to say yes to him? And the answers that are given, certainly the first two answers that we'll take a look at, I would say are very lofty indeed. And they need to be. They need to be higher than the natural desire to take revenge. It needs to be a higher vision. What is that higher vision? And the first explanation, the first basis for the prohibition of not taking revenge, is actually to be found in the Yerushalmi, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, in Maseches Nedarim, in the ninth perek. And the Yerushalmi gives a mashal. And of course, when we hear it, we'll instantly relate to the mashal, but then we translate it into the nimshal, to the moral of the story. Says the Yerushalmi, imagine a person who's working with his hands, and he with a blade or with a hammer or something like that, and accidentally one hand damages or injures the other hand. Could we envisage or even imagine that the second hand would then, out of revenge, injure the first hand? The first hand injure the second, so the second will get his own back and injure the first hand. It's inconceivable, because as unfortunate as it is that the one hand injured the second, but in the end, it's all the same person. And one injury is better than two. And what the Yerushalmi means to say, as we move into the Nimshal, is if you see yourself as distinct from your fellow Jew, so that he said no to me, so I'm going to say no to him. That's a natural thing. But maybe you shouldn't be looking at your fellow Jew like that. Maybe you should have a higher vision of what the Jewish people are. At the ultimate, the oneness of the Jewish people is not just that they are one community. They are one unity. They are one entity which is called Israel. Which means that when one of them says no to the other, it's like the one hand hitting the other. The other hand will get his own back and damage the first hand. It's all one. So this is, I think, is a very high vision. As if to say, if you only come to look at all the Jewish people as one, then you will naturally feel no desire to take revenge. Well, but indeed, as lofty as it is, it remains an aspiration. It shouldn't go missing from our horizon, because the ultimate expression of the oneness of the Jewish people is that they really are one entity. There is a fascinating explanation which is offered by Reb Shimon Shkop in the introduction to his Sefer Shara Yosha. Reb Shimon Shkop was the Rosh Hashiva of Grodno, and he was known as a towering Torah scholar in Talmud. But he has an introduction to his magnum opus, Shara Yosha, and in that he has some truly wonderful ideas, very inspiring, very elevating. And he diverts our attention to Hillel's famous words in Pirkei Avos. Hillel would say, "Im ein ani li mili," if I am not for myself, who will be for me? "Ukeshani la'atzmi, ma ani," if I'm only for myself, then what am I? And then "Im ein achshav, emosai," which is the third. If not now, when? But let's focus on the first two. On a simple level, Hillel is saying, I've got to look out for, on the one hand, I've got to look out for myself. "Im ein ani li mili," if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? I have to look out for myself. However, the counterpoint to that is I can't just only look out for myself. If I'm just for myself, then what type of person am I? I should be looking out for others also. And life is about finding the balance between those things. That is the simple understanding of the Mishnah. Reb Shimon Shkop says there's a deeper level here. Because if, again, if we look closely at the words, and we're familiar with the words of this Mishnah, we'll note there's been a change in phraseology. Because it began by saying, Im ein ani li, if I am not for li, for myself, who will be for me? But the second clause says, Ukeshani la'atzmi, if I am for atzmi, which again means for myself. So how come in the first clause, myself is called li, for me, and the second clause it's called la'atzmi, for myself? But me and myself are the same. So why the shift from li to atzmi? And again, worth it for the question. One could read the Mishnah many, many times and not notice that we've gone from ani li to ani la'atzmi. Says Reb Shimon Shkop, I remember hearing this from my father Zatzal many years ago. The first clause states, im ein ani li mi li. I have to be looking out for myself. That's true. The question is, who am I? Who is ani? I need to look out for ani. But if ani is la'atzmi, if my conception of ani, of me, is only for myself, meaning I'm the only one who's included in that category called ani, ma'ani, then what type of ani is that? That's not a Jewish me. A Jewish me has all of the Jewish people in it. So in other words, I do need to be li. I need to be li, me for myself. But ani shouldn't be restricted to atzmi. Ani is everyone, because if ani is just atzmi, ma ani, what type of ani is that? And that really is Reb Shimon Shkop's way of resonating what the Yerushalmi is saying, that if all the Jewish people are one, there's no, then thoughts of revenge are simply obsolete, inoperable. And this is the explanation of the Yerushalmi. Moving to the second explanation as to what is behind not taking revenge. And again, I think the desire for revenge is natural enough that we need all the help that we can get in terms of explanations as to why we shouldn't do it. The Sefer HaChinuch discusses this. And he provides his own form of very lofty explanation. And that is, says Sefer HaChinuch, a person needs to realize that whatever happens to them in life has been ordained from above. Which means if someone wrongs them and their only thoughts are, how can I wrong them back? They've missed a major message, which is that it has been ordained for them to have this discomfort or this distress. They should rather look inwards, says the Sefer HaChinuch, in terms of wondering why this is happening to them and what they can fix, as opposed to trying to damage the messenger of that message from heaven. And he actually quotes an example from Tanakh of this idea. In Sefer Shmuel Beis, so you have the episode with David HaMelech, and David HaMelech had a lot of difficulties. In this particular episode, Shimi ben Gera, who was the head of the Sanhedrin, in fact, he starts cursing David HaMelech in a terrible way. So much so that David's generals want to take his head off, to silence him. It's an absolute terrible situation. And David stills them. And he says to them, don't take action against him. If he's cursing me, it's because Hashem told him to curse me. Hashem amar lo kalelis David. And this, says the Sefer HaChinuch, is the prototype of how to deal with situations like this. If a person does something to you, it's like David said about Shimi ben Gera. Hashem told him to do it. So my introspection now should be the order of the day, not payback towards that particular person. I have to say, it's very difficult to mention this idea of the Sefer HaChinuch without also mentioning that this is not a simple matter at all. In fact, it brings to mind the famous comment of the Or HaChaim HaKadosh in Parshas Vayeshev, which actually is stated practically explicitly in the Zohar HaKadosh in Parshas Vayeshev on exactly the same matter. Because here is the Sefer HaChinuch saying, if a person wrongs you, you should know that that was ordained from heaven. The reason why that's a very complex statement is because although heaven will have its plans, but people have free will. And if these two things cannot be absolutes, you cannot say that nothing happens if it's not ordained from heaven at all, and you cannot say a person is capable of doing whatever they want. Those two as absolutes cannot exist because they will clash. They will clash in a situation where a person decides to do something that was not ordained by heaven. So can he do that? And if he can, then in a sense, free will impinges on heaven's plans. If he can't, then heaven's plans impinge on a person's free will. The Sefer HaChinuch has very clearly taken the approach that a person cannot choose to do something to you if it hasn't been ordained from heaven. That's why he says, if a person wrongs you, it's a message from heaven. Which means for him, it's heaven's plans that impinge on free will. The person, of course, still has to answer for his actions. But that shouldn't be your first response. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh, and as we said, the Zohar as well, as quoted by the Netziv in Parshas Vayeshev, famously says otherwise. In explanation of Reuven's act to save Yosef. The brothers are about to kill Yosef, and the Pasuk says, Vayishma Reuven Vayatzilehu Miyodom. Reuven, he heard the brothers are going to kill Yosef, and he saved him. And what did he do? He said, throw him in the pit. Says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, you call that saving? What's in the pit? Snakes and scorpions. If that's called salvation, I don't know what the condemnation is. I mean, that's hardly a reprieve. I mean, these are deadly things, snakes and scorpions. So how is that called saving him? Says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, it is saving him. Because if Yosef is a tzaddik, so then Reuven has confidence that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not allow snakes and scorpions, who have no free will, they only have their nature, Hashem would not allow them to harm him. But even if he's a tzaddik, the brothers could still harm him, because they have free will. And therefore, says the Orach Chaim, he really is more at risk out of the pit than in the pit. In the pit, he only needs to contend with forces of nature. They can be suspended if he's a tzaddik. But out of the pit, he needs to contend with human nature, which will not be suspended, even if he's a tzaddik. And therefore, that's called saving him, to throw him into a pit with snakes and scorpions. And the basic idea behind what the Orach Chaim HaKadosh is saying is that free will can impinge, it can encroach on heaven's plans, and a person can damage someone else, or worse, even if that was not ordained by heaven. As we can appreciate, a very weighty discussion. What about the case of Shimi ben Gera, quoted by the Chinuch? He cursed David, and David said, Hashem is telling him to curse. Doesn't that confirm the Chinuch's idea that every person's actions are a message from heaven? So interestingly, if you look at Rashi in the Navi, on that Pasuk, when David says, don't take action against Shimi, if he's cursing me, it must be that Hashem told him to curse me. Why is David saying that? Says Rashi, because it was such an incomprehensible episode. Shimi ben Gera is the head of the Sanhedrin. This is so out of character. It is so irrational. It is so inexplicable. In normal terms, in that situation, one can only ascribe it to being divinely ordained. But if we read between the lines, really what Rashi is saying is, that's not to say that whenever anyone does something against a person, it's divinely ordained. It's just if it's so out of character and so strange and impossible to explain, then the only explanation could be divinely ordained. So these are the two explanations, just to summarize them, to make sure these are heavy sources, weighty sources. The Yerushalmi, why not take revenge? Because the Jewish people are all one. One doesn't take revenge against itself. For the Sefer HaChinuch, why not take revenge? It's a message from heaven. Don't take revenge against the messenger. What these two ideas have in common is that they take something which we would consider to be a negative prohibition, a don't do, but they bring it into the realms of a do. In other words, the deeper approach to this is not passive, as if to say, don't take revenge. It's active. Actively develop a perspective which will then naturally preclude thoughts of taking revenge. So it's very interesting that at the heart of what would certainly seem to be a negative prohibition is an active command of how to look at things. And with regards to bearing a grudge, all that comes to mind is the famous statement of Dr. Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Twersky, Rabbi Avraham Yehoshua, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, that the one who suffers most from bearing a grudge is the one who bears the grudge. He says if you bear a grudge against someone, it's the equivalent of drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. They're merrily on their way, and you're the one who's suffering. So in the interest of a person's own health, grudges need to go. But there is a third approach. And for what it's worth, I consider this approach to be perhaps of the equally, if not more, accessible as to understand why not to take revenge. And it comes from the Rambam. And it's such an amazing thing for the Rambam, because the Rambam is in the Mishnah Torah, is a work of halachas. Halachas is what to do and not what to do. So the Rambam doesn't need to explain why you shouldn't do something or how you come not to do something. But in Hilchos Deos, in Perek Zayin, Halacha Zayin, the Rambam talks about the prohibition of taking revenge. And the Rambam says, it's forbidden for a person to take revenge, and it's a terrible thing to do so. A person should be foregoing. Ra'oi lios ma'avir al midosav. A person should be easygoing, to be foregoing. Al kol divrei ha'olam, in all matters of this world. Shehakol etel ha'mivinim divrei hevel v'havai. Because people, and these I think are the key words of Rambam, for people who understand, for people of developed understanding, matters of this world are of no ultimate consequence. Ve'einan kedai linkom aleihem. It's not worth taking revenge over. Unbelievable words of explanation. In other words, according to the Rambam, the way a person reaches a stage where they will feel that they don't need to take revenge is they just need to get a correct perspective, not on the other person, but on the events that happened. The end of the day, what did the person do? And whatever it is, it's just matters of this world. They're not of ultimate purpose. They're not of ultimate significance. We're all familiar with people who get worked up over things which aren't really important. And we, of course, bastions of wisdom, observe them from the side. But the Rambam says, but everything in life is like that. Nothing is really worth getting worked up about. And if you know that, it takes the pressure of taking revenge off. One could say, if I could use it in the colloquial sense, it's a philosophical approach. It's philosophical in the sense that you don't let things get to you because you have a more elevated vision as to what has happened. Those are the words of the Rambam. And I would just like to add that perhaps in light of this explanation of the Rambam, we can understand the flow of this pasuk. We've spent the last few moments talking about don't take revenge, don't bear a grudge. But how does the pasuk conclude? With the famous words, Va'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor, love your fellow as yourself. And the question is, what's the connection between those two things? I think the standard approach would be that it's a progression. As if to say, don't do anything negative. And in fact, even move towards the positive. Don't take revenge. Don't bear a grudge, and one should even love your neighbor as yourself. So it's a progression as the pasuk moves on. But I believe, based on the Rambam, that these two parts of the verse, they're not a progression. They are a point and a counterpoint for the following reason. Rambam says that when the first part of the verse says, don't take revenge, you know why you shouldn't take revenge? Because what did they do to you at the end of the day? Nothing, really. Because whatever they did, it's just things of this world. They're not as important as you think they are. They're not as significant as you think they are. They're not really significant at all. That is the perspective to develop in order to preclude feelings of vengeance. And if you develop that perspective, you are in a potentially dangerous situation. Because you're one step away of declaring not only the event as being of little significance, but the person behind the event of being of little significance. In other words, if you fully adopt this approach, so you look around you and you say, nothing's important, and no one is important. Nothing really matters, and no one really matters. Events are not meant to be taken seriously, and neither are the people who are behind those events to be taken seriously. And to that end, the Torah says, no, that's not true. The things that people do are not always of great impact or significance, but people are always of great significance. And therefore, the Torah says, you need to develop this balance. On the one hand, so-and-so did such-and-such to you, such-and-such is not important, but so-and-so is, because they're re'acha. And therefore, it's a point and a counterpoint. As much as you're developing this philosophical approach with regards to the things that happen, lo tikum v'lo titor, but in terms of the people that made them happen, v'ahavta l'recha kamecha, don't throw them out together with the, and don't be as dismissive of them as you were of the things that they may have done. I think that's really the harmony in this pasuk of pasuk Yudches. Okay, so having done, I hope, some measure of justice to pasuk Yudches, let us move back to pasuk Yud Zayin, the mitzvah of tochacha, the mitzvah of rebuke. Many, many major central mitzvahs in Parshas Kedoshim, as Rashi himself said, Rov Gufei Torah Tuluyim Bo. Many major mitzvahs here. So Pasuk Yud Zayin begins, Lo Tisnas Echicha Bilvavecha, don't hate your brother in your heart, Hocheach Tochiach Es Amisecha, you shall surely rebuke your fellow, Velo Sisa Alav Chet, and do not bear sin on his behalf. Hocheach Tochiach Es Amisecha. You shall surely rebuke your fellow. As we can appreciate, a very delicate mitzvah, rebuking others, a very sensitive mitzvah. And in fact, in the Gemara, we find a most unusual discussion as to the parameters of this mitzvah. The Gemara raises the question in Maseches Erechin, Daf Tet Zayin. How many times do you need to rebuke a person? How many times is sufficient? Until when? If you rebuke them and they're not listening, should you do it again? And if so, how many times? And the Gemara records a most fascinating discussion, a three-way machlokas as to how many times you need to rebuke the person. The first opinion says, until they strike you. The second opinion says, until they curse you. And the third opinion says, until they insult you. I think it's fair to say there is no other mitzvah which has any such parameters. When it comes to any other mitzvah, if you have to do it, you have to do it, even regardless of whatever the other person does. And here you have this, and they cite psukim, and it's a very detailed situation. But what's it all about? If a person is shaking lulav, and someone else hits him or insults him, he's got to do the mitzvah. But the truth is, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that this machlokas in the Gemara, this unusual machlokas, striking, insulting, cursing, it takes us into the heart of what rebuke is all about. As we can appreciate, it's very easy for rebuke to be administered wrongly. And in fact, it preys on what might be a natural instinct within a person. If you naturally enjoy correcting other people and telling them what to do, I mean, this is literally a godsend. It could very easily become your favorite mitzvah in the entire Torah. In fact, all the other mitzvahs are perhaps only commentary on this one mitzvah. They're the other 612 ways to fulfill it. But Rambam gives us the key. And Rambam says, again in Hilchos Deos, in order for the mitzvah of rebuke to be considered done correctly, the other person needs to know that you have their well-being at heart. That is the key to rebuke administered correctly. If it is clear to them that you are what you're saying is you're saying what you're saying because you have their well-being at heart, then that is considered good rebuke. But if that's not clear to them, it is not considered to be correct rebuke at all. And the way, again, my father from even further back, I remember him raising the simple question. And this, I think, is the defining question. And we can't shy away from rebuke when we need to do it, but we need to know exactly what's involved. A person needs to ask themselves when they're about to get involved in correcting another person. What is your goal? What is your motivation? Is your motivation to help them get it right? To help them do it right? Or is your motivation to let them know that they did it wrong? Those are two completely different outcomes. And one is kosher and one is not kosher. If your goal is to help them do it right, then that should come across. But if your goal is only to let them know that they got it wrong, that will also come across. And it won't have a good outcome. And this, and in fact, if we look at the verses, I think the whole pasuk now comes together. Firstly, because the in pasuk Yud Zayin, which is where these words are from, administering rebuke is the middle clause. Hocheach tocheach es amisecha, you shall rebuke your fellow. Velo sisa olav chet, don't bear a sin on his behalf. What sin might you bear on his behalf? What's it got to do with rebuking him? Rashi explains, because rebuke could turn into a sin. If you rebuke him in a way that embarrasses him, or embarrasses him publicly, certainly. So your mitzvah called rebuke turned into a sin. The Torah says, be sure that the mitzvah of administering rebuke remains a mitzvah and doesn't become a sin. This can be potentially a great disappointment for some people. As far as they're concerned, the mitzvah is to rebuke the person, and the hidur mitzvah is to embarrass them. And if it's done in public, that's mahadrin mina mahadrin. I mean, these are the higher levels of the mitzvah. And it's a disavowing of that notion. The Torah says no. Tochacha is meant to make them feel better, not worse. And so much so that if we go back to the beginning of the pasuk, which begins with those very stark words, lo sisna esachicha bilvavecha, don't hate your brother in your heart, and then goes on to say, rebuke your brother. What is the flow? The flow is, it's possible for rebuke to be an expression of hatred, of disdain, of dismissal, of negation. And the Torah says, if you have feelings, negative feelings towards your brother in your heart, you can't proceed to rebuke them. First things first, lo sisna esachicha bilvavecha. You got to get rid of any negative feeling. If you still feel you want to rebuke them, okay, now you can proceed. Hocheach tocheach. And this, I believe, was picked up on by, again, Hillel in Pirkei Avos, who says to us, instructs us, Hevei mitamidov shel Aaron, try and be like the students of Aaron. Ohev shalom, rotev shalom, should love peace, pursue peace. Ohev es habrios, umekarva na Torah. You should love people and bring them close to Torah. That's a flow. That's a progression. A leads to B. First, it needs to start with ohev es habrios. If you love people, from that part, mekarva na Torah, you should be mekarv them. It's Hillel's way of really, again, harmonizing with the pasuk. The pasuk stated it in the basic way. Remove feelings of hatred from your heart. Then you can proceed. Hillel says, introduce feelings of love into your heart. And then you can proceed. Umekarvan la Torah. And says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, this will explain to us that very unusual sounding dispute as to how many times does a person need to rebuke their fellow? And you have a three-way machlokas between the weightiest of Talmudic personalities, Rav, Shmuel, and Rabbi Yochanan. I mean, they start all Talmudic discussions. And one says till he hits you, and one says till he insults you, and one says till he curses you. And what is this? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, really what they're discussing is not at what point have you fulfilled the mitzvah. They're saying, at what point is it abundantly clear that you are incapable of fulfilling the mitzvah? At that point, you need to desist. In other words, if we go back to our lulav example, you don't put the lulav down when you finished waving it with your hoshanas. You put the lulav down if it disintegrates in your hands and turns to dust. At that point, there's nothing to wave anymore. If you're rebuking someone and they're responding so badly, you stop because you are incapable of fulfilling the mitzvah of tochacha. So there's other mitzvahs to do. So you should do them. There is a fascinating comment of the Shaloh HaKadosh. Because the correct way to administer rebuke, it makes a world of difference, as we're saying. One is a mitzvah and one's not a mitzvah. That's already a difference. But the Pasuk says in Mishlei, Al tochach leitz, don't give tochacha to a leitz, to a scoffer. Pen yisna'eka, because he may just hate you. Hochech lechacham, give rebuke to a wise man, v'yavecha, and then he'll love you. So the Pasuk again says, don't give rebuke to a scoffer. That will end badly. Give rebuke to a wise person. So it makes perfect sense. The problem is, what about the scoffer? He's left to languish. You can't go near him because it will end badly. So just choose wise people. You know, if you choose wise people, they're probably largely okay anyway. So in other words, you're only really taking care of the people who don't really need to be taken care of. And you're leaving the ones that really do need your help, you're leaving them adrift. But the Shaloh HaKadosh says no. The two parts of the verse are not referring to two different groups of people. They're not referring to two people. They're referring to two different ways to relate to the same person. If you see someone doing something wrong, so you yourself can react in two ways. You can either say, oh, it's terrible, there's no hope for them, they're a terrible person, I'm sure, I've got to do my Orthodox Jew duty, but this is really a terrible situation. I'm pretty sure that they don't care about anything, and here I go. Says Shlomo HaMelech, don't engage in that way. Don't give rebuke to the person as a leitz. Your greeting card for your rebuke cannot be, I'm sure you have no values, but I'm here to correct you anyway. Rather, hochach lechacham, give rebuke to a wise man, meaning that very same person. Treat them like a wise person. Treat them like a person of understanding. Treat them like a person who does have values, who does care. You'll be surprised. It's the very same person. But if the message that with which you greet them is, you're hopeless, but I've got to tell you anyway, whereas opposed to, I'm sure you're a wise person, let's have a talk about such and such, it's the very same person, but two completely different angles. And this then is the art of tochacha. And it really is an art. And on the contrary, the more we are aware of its potential pitfalls, the more we can hopefully be sure always to do it in the right way. I must say, whenever I think of the idea of rebuke administered correctly, there is an episode that comes to mind. It's an episode, it's from another world. But even so, even things that are light years away, they might not be at hand, but at least they give us a certain direction. And it's told by a survivor of one of the camps. And he says that every morning they would line up, they were given one piece of bread. On a good day, they were given one piece of bread for the day, and that's it. So what does everyone do? Everyone's starving. And they get the piece of bread, they eat it as quick as they can. They don't want anything to happen to it. And they can barely control themselves. And he said, and that's what I did too. I would line up and I get my piece of bread. I can't control myself. And it's nothing. And he says, one day, I'm standing in line. I get my piece of bread from the commandant of the camp. I put it in my mouth as quick as I can. And then from behind me, I feel someone taps me on the shoulder. So who are they? What do they want? I've eaten my food. What do they want from me? What can they take from me? So I turn around anyway. And there's an older Jew there who somehow had still survived. And he said to me, I see you put the bread in your mouth without making a bracha. That's not how a Jew should eat. Imagine hearing that. Got to make a bracha before you eat. Who could make such a demand of anyone in that situation? And then he said, this older person who just received his piece of bread, he took it and he divided it in two and gave half of it to me and said, here, try again, this time with a bracha. If there's anything that epitomizes tochacha for the sake of heaven, that is that Jew who was prepared to part with half of his starvation rations, not only to tell the young Jew in front of him that he got it wrong, but to see him get it right. That is a standard. Again, light years away, but that's the direction that we should be heading in. And so these are the themes, again, the major mitzvahs, the two that we were able to discuss this evening. But a person needs to act with wisdom. A person needs to know exactly when to say, how to say. In fact, there are certain times when it's quite clear that there isn't what to say. It won't be well received at this time. The Gemara itself says, in the same way there's a mitzvah to say things that will be heard, there's a mitzvah not to say things that won't be heard. Every person needs to gauge the situation. If you know from the outset that, especially if it's a group, it will be badly received, etc. So the mitzvah is to bleibstum at that stage. We'll finish just with a bit of a happier story. And it's said about one of the Rebbes, there was a woman in the village, and she was in terrible debt. She was a widow, and she had children to raise, and the debts were becoming intolerable. And she needed a break. And she owed money to this bank, and basically the debt had to be cancelled, otherwise she would completely go under. It happened to be the manager of the bank was a Jew, not an observant Jew, but he was Jewish. And the Rebbe of the town, decided he's going to pay him a visit. So he knocks on his door, he goes to this gentleman, and he sees the Rebbe, he comes in, he says, Rebbe, how can I help you? The Rebbe says, I'm come here for a mitzvah. So he says, please come in, sits him down in the study, and they're sitting there, and nothing's happening. No one's talking. Rebbe doesn't say anything. So the balabos at a certain point says, Rebbe, you said you came here for a mitzvah. And the Rebbe said, yes, I did. So he said, well, what is the mitzvah? So the Rebbe said, I'm doing it now. So the gevir says, well, you're not doing anything. You're just sitting there. And he said, yes, that's my mitzvah. But how is that? How is saying nothing a mitzvah? So the Rebbe says, because the Gemara says, in the same way that there's a mitzvah to say something that will be heard, there's a mitzvah not to say something that won't be heard. I have something that I need to say to you, but I know that you will not listen. So I came here to fulfill the mitzvah of not saying something that will go unheeded. And that's what I'm doing. So once the Gevir heard that, he said, Rebbe, you've got to tell me what it is. The Rebbe said, I can't. Because you won't do it. But this person was exploding with their curiosity. He says, you have to tell me, I'll do it. So the Rebbe says, you will? He said, yeah. He says, okay. There's this woman in town. She's alone with her children. She's run up a debt. You need to cancel the debt. So the Balabas says, Rebbe, I'm the manager of the bank, but it's not my bank. It's not my money. And the Rebbe says, I told you you wouldn't do it. That's why I didn't say anything. So now the person was caught. He said, but I can't do it. He says, I know. And that's why, and you made me tell you. But that's why I didn't want to say anything. And it finally reached a stage where this person says, you know what, Rebbe, I made you say it. I'll work it out. And he put his own holdings at stake, etc., in order to clear the debt. So that is what I guess you could call a very loud silence from the Rebbe. But the moral of the story is to act with wisdom, to act with compassion. As Hillel says, Oevus habiras mekarvan haTorah, a little love goes a long way in the art of rebuke. And let us just conclude by going back to the beginning of the Parsha. Kadoshim tiyu, you shall be holy, says Hashem, because I am holy. What does that mean? The Medrash says, if you sanctify yourselves, I consider it, this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking, Om HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Im atem mekadshim atzmechem, if you sanctify yourselves, Ma le'ani aleichem, ki ilu kidashtem osi. I consider it as if you sanctified me. Words that if the Medrash didn't say it, you couldn't even think to say them. Hashem says, if you sanctify yourselves, it's like you sanctified me. What could that possibly mean? So the Mezuzah Magid explains that when we talk of Hashem, it's only ever His relationship with us. I mean, we never really know Hashem in abstract. Hashem's relationship with us depends on us. The more we put into that relationship and the more we behave in accordance with the Torah, so the more HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds. And we call that sanctifying Hashem because more of His sanctity can then come into the world. And therefore, the underlying and overarching message of Parshas Kedoshim is that imatem mekadshim atzmechem, if you are dedicated to Torah and mitzvahs and to the Jewish people, which is the holiest of causes, and you act with sanctity and develop yourself with sanctity, so it's like you sanctified HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because midah keneged midah, that sanctity can come down. And of course, we can never do with too much of that. Certainly, we could do with a good bit of it in our current climate, and therefore this should be a source of chizuk for us to hear in concrete terms, not in abstract terms, in concrete terms, the Torah's instruction of Kedoshim Tiyu with all that goes with it, and that should serve to bring more and more Kedusha into the world. I wish you all a wonderful evening and a great week ahead. All the very best.